Makes life easier, doesn't it? Oh, thanks.
That was a good starting comment. Yeah.
Yeah. Good morning. This is the education sub of Ways and Means, and it is May the 12th, 2 days from Revenue Forecast Day, which is what some of us have been waiting for. Mr. Wilson, where are we today?
Mr. Chair, members, there for the next 3 days, you'll be hearing from HEC, Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Today will be around the Oregon Opportunity Grant, both in terms of the budget bill, as well as holding a formal public hearing on House Bill 2407, which really is the bill that implements the change in the distribution of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Tomorrow you have Higher Education Coordinating Commission will be back in front of you to talk about outcome-based or performance-based distribution for both the community college and the public university, the general support payments that go to each of those sets of entities. And then on Thursday, there will be another one like last Thursday with Department of Education, sort of a number of different policy packages will be discussed, some of which are formal policy packages proposed by the governor. Some are things that have come up since the that budget was put together. And for higher education, remember, this is a brand new agency, and I think some of the things are still being there's still some growing pains in trying to get some of the, you know, the capacity and the infrastructure of the agency to put together. So that type of things will be discussed on Thursday. So today you have Mr. Cannon and Mr. Brew from HEC talking about the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
And we'll open a public hearing on 5024 and 2407. And Mr. Cannon and Mr. Brew.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Great to be back. As Doug said, we'll present over the next few days sort of further elaboration and articulation of some of the priorities and budget items that we discussed with you when we gave our agency presentation, but appreciate the opportunity to go into greater depth. Today, we're focused on the Oregon Opportunity Grant, the two bills, one the funding bill, the budget bill for this grant. The other are proposed policy changes related to it, House Bill 2407. I'm going to turn it over to Bob to provide most of this presentation. Let me just at the outset say, when you're thinking about affordability in higher education, as our commission spent a lot of time thinking about during the interim, knowing that there would be substantial interest and need to make an affordability-focused investment, our commission, the Higher Education Commission, concluded the single highest priority for those investments should be to put dollars into the state's need-based grant program, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, that this program, the Opportunity Grant, most effectively and with greatest sort of priority and success, focuses state investment on students who need it to help them meet their affordability gap and in a way that is consistent with our recognition and appreciation for what students can and should be expected to contribute to their own educations, takes into account other forms of financial aid, potential family contribution. This, we believe, is and should be the highest priority for state affordability investments. At the same time, our commission also concluded that the way in which we deliver those investments ought to be modified, that the program itself ought to be redesigned, not overhauled, but amended to more clearly focus those investments on the highest need students. And that's where the policy bill, House Bill 2407, comes into play. Bob will discuss sort of the way that the Opportunity Grant is structured today, the way that we're proposing to redesign it, and then our budget bill, House Bill 5024, recommends to you additional state investments in a redesigned program in order to serve more students and in order to serve the students who need the dollars the very most. Without very significantly greater levels of investment, levels that are really probably not on the table for you. We cannot meet the affordability need of students in our state, but we can focus the dollars where they will have the greatest impact and where there is the greatest need, and that's what we're presenting our recommendations to you on today. Let me turn it over to Bob.
Thank you.
Mr. Brew.
Good morning, Chair Monroe, Chair Comp, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, commonly known as OSAC. I'm here this morning to discuss the Oregon Opportunity Grant, where it came from, where it's been, and where it's going. I'll keep it at a fairly high level, and I'm more than willing to answer any questions you may have. First, a little bit of trivia. I love this stuff. In 1965, U.S. Representative Edith Green of the great state of Oregon introduced U.S. House of Representatives Resolution 9567, which, when ultimately signed by President Johnson, became known as the Higher Education Act of 1965. You may have heard of it. This act created broadly available financial aid programs for students pursuing a college education, and it's the granddaddy of all, or grandmommy, of all financial aid programs out there today.
That was a good year. I started teaching high school that year in 1965.
In 1971, with
born
the help
yet.
I'm sorry. In 1971, with the help of some federal matching funds, your predecessors in the Oregon legislature created the Oregon Need Grant and the Oregon Scholastic Grant. The Need Grant was based solely on the prospective student's financial circumstances, while the Scholastic Grant created a certain level of academic performance in addition to financial need. Over the succeeding 28 years, these programs went through many changes until 1999, when the Oregon legislature created the Oregon Opportunity Grant, Oregon's only need-based college grant. The basic requirements haven't changed much over the years, as outlined over these next few slides. To be eligible for the grant, you must be a resident of the state of Oregon, a U.S. citizen or eligible non-citizen. You must be an undergraduate student with no prior bachelor's degrees, and you have to be enrolled for at least 6 credit hours at an Oregon public university, community college, or an approved Oregon-based nonprofit college or university. Perhaps obviously, you have to demonstrate that you have financial need, you can't have defaulted on any federal loans, and you have to be eligible to receive student aid under Title IV, meaning you've registered for the Selective Service if you're a male and haven't been convicted of selling drugs. Here are a few of the basic rules of the grant. First, students are only eligible to receive the grant for 4 years of full-time enrollment, which we define as 12 credit hours per quarter or semester. This follows the federal definition, and pay attention because it will come up later. We prorate the awards for half-time or partial year enrollment. Students have to meet the federal definition of satisfactory academic progress or their particular college's definition, whichever is stricter. Students must apply annually. This is not a renewable grant currently, and the grant can't be accessed by students taking courses towards a degree in theology, divinity, or religious education. And lastly, when we don't have enough money to fund everyone, we limit awards to those who are enrolled at least half-time during fall term. In other words, we don't reserve some portion of grant funds for students that don't start until the winter or spring terms. Prior to 2008, OSAC based a student's eligibility for opportunity grant on family income and household size. OSAC used information from the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, which I will refer to as the FAFSA, to determine each student's federal total income, a combination of adjusted gross income and untaxed income. Income limits were based on a percentage of median family income for Oregon as determined by the U.S. Census Bureau and published each spring in the Federal Register. For example, in 2006-2007, opportunity grants were awarded to dependent applicants whose parents' income was no more than 55% of Oregon median family income. And for independent student applicants with a spouse and/or dependents, the income limit was 50% of the median family income and 30% of the median family income for single independent applicants. So the table in this slide shows annual income limits for the 9 years prior to implementation of the shared responsibility model, which I will get to in a minute. Income limits were adjusted to accommodate household size and number in college, and only students whose federal incomes were at or below the income threshold received grants. Annual award amounts for each academic sector were equal to approximately 11% of the standard cost of attendance for a typical student. using detailed cost information that OSAC's Administrators for State Grants and Government Affairs collects annually from all participating institutions. Cost of attendance includes non-tuition costs across all sectors, for example, room and board, books and supplies, transportation, and miscellaneous expenses, plus tuition and fees. OSAC used average tuition and fees at public institutions, but because of the wide range of actual costs at private nonprofit four-year institutions, students' awards were based on actual tuition and fees plus an average of non-tuition costs across all sectors. OSAC saw significant funding increases in Opportunity Grant Program in 2005 to 2007, so OSAC was able to serve 98% of eligible full-time students in 2005-06. In 06-07 and 07-08, OSAC served all eligible full-time and half-time students. This changed with the start of the Great Recession in 2008 and implementation of the Shared Responsibility Model in 2008-2009. Since 2007, the mechanism outlined in statute for distributing the Opportunity Grant has been the Shared Responsibility Model, or SRM. The SRM states that students, families, the federal government, and the state of Oregon all have a vested interest in supporting higher education attainment for Oregon students, and they all share the responsibility for making that happen. Under SRM, the student is in the first position for funding their education, and the state of Oregon is in the last position by statute. This slide depicts how the contributions of each of those funding partners is calculated. In first position, the student's share is based on a student working an average of 15 hours per week for 48 weeks of the year at Oregon minimum wage. Currently, this total is rounded to $6,000 for community college students and $9,000 for university students. So a university student is expected to have some modest level of student debt, currently $3,000. In second position is the expected family contribution, or EFC. This is a figure derived via the FAFSA and takes into account family and student income in most cases, family assets, number in the household, and so on. In spite of what the name might imply, the federal government states that this figure reflects an ability to pay, not necessarily an expectation of payment. Nevertheless, it is an important component of the SRM. Obviously, an EFC of zero represents the poorest of the poor, those least able to afford to contribute to the cost of their education. Due to the mechanizations of the model, you're less likely to qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant the higher your EFC, and it's very rare for any student with an EFC higher than $5,000 to qualify for the Opportunity Grant. In third position is the federal government. Outside of student loans, the feds primarily help students fund their education in two ways: the Pell Grant, which is the federal government's need-based grant, and various tax credits, which are generally available to middle-income households. The Pell tops out at slightly less than $5,800 per year for the neediest students, but lesser amounts are available for students of slightly higher means. Lastly, Oregon statute states that the last piece of puzzle is the state's share. This is where the Oregon Opportunity Grant fits into the pyramid. It was to be the last dollar in. Once all other players have contributed their share, the state would make up the difference. And it worked that way for the first couple of years of the Shared Responsibility Model, as you will see in this slide. This slide shows what happens to a typical very needy university student, that is, one with a zero EFC in the years since the Shared Responsibility Model was enacted. Particularly instructive is the column from 2009-2010, the second from the left. As you can see, all four players participated and were able to fully cover the $16,425 in costs for that year. As you move to the right across the graph, you can see that none of the components of funding a student's education under SRM have kept pace with the rising cost of higher education. Certainly, tuition and fees have gone up, but so have room and board and books and supplies as well. Neither the Pell Grant, minimum wage, nor family incomes have grown nearly as fast. So the state's share of the SRM, that last dollar in, has theoretically grown ever larger. The brown part of the column shows the part of the state's share that is being paid through the Opportunity Grant, and the crosshatched section above that is the state share that currently isn't funded. This slide shows basically the same.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to catch you before you moved on. So just to review, or to make sure I have this right. So these are for folks who had a zero expected family contribution. So the $3,000 in the middle one, that is not the family share, that is loans.
Senator Monroe, Representative Comp, Representative Smith Former, yes, for university students, that's an expectation of $3,000 in loans.
Okay.
And on the next slide, I will show that community colleges, by statute, we don't include any loan expectation for community college students.
Thank you.
So this slide shows basically the same story over the past 14 years for a family with a federally calculated EFC of zero, that is the poorest of the poor, at a community college. As you can see, the contributions of all the participants have risen over time, but not nearly as fast as the total cost has, leaving the state with the fastest increasing share and a large portion that isn't funded, leaving students to borrow ever more to fill that gap. As you can see, the grant is only about a third of what the state's share should be under the shared responsibility model. In addition to the gap in the state's share growing ever larger, many more students now qualify for the grant. This chart shows the number of students eligible for the grant over the past 7 years. In contrast, this chart juxtaposes the eligible students with the number of awards we can actually fund. Most recently, you can see that we're able to provide grants to only about 20% of the eligible students. So this was my quandary. I had nearly 200,000 potential students who are eligible for the opportunity grant, and there was nothing in statute that provided any direction on how these scarce dollars should be prioritized. Over the past several years, we've had to triage our awards using a sort of first-come, first-served approach. This has never seemed very equitable, but it was the best we could do without clarity in the statute. And we hope that the provisions of House Bill 2407 will provide some clarity. Legislative interest in the most effective use of the opportunity grant investment led to the Oregon Education Investment Board giving a charge to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to address a series of questions concerning the design and allocation of the grant in the context of state needs. The HEC convened a financial aid work group in November of 2013 that met through the spring of 2014. And in a moment, you'll meet Chair Larry Roper of that group. As depicted in this slide, the work group examined the 40-40-20 goals of the state, in addition to the fiscal realities of state budgets, and they looked at the seemingly conflicting goals of improving access based on need while actively rewarding success and completion. In the course of their analysis, the financial aid work group developed the following goal: to recommend a restructured Oregon Opportunity Grant program that will both achieve the goal of improving access to higher education and vocational and technical education for promising financially needy underrepresented students and stimulate the achievement of the state of Oregon's 40-40-20 goals. The work group believed if appropriately funded and awarded, the Oregon Opportunity Grant can stimulate aspirations, access, enrollment, retention, performance, and completion. The working group had many suggestions for redesigning the grant, but they essentially could be reduced down to these two themes: increase the predictability in the granting process and target the grant on the most needy until such time as funding is available to serve more students. In terms of increasing predictability, the working group felt strongly that focusing the grant more tightly on the highest need students would allow a longer application period. I will demonstrate the importance of that in a moment. The group also believed that students would be more likely to continue in their second year of college if they knew that help would be available. For that reason, they decided to introduce the idea of a two-year guarantee. As long as a student still had need and was making satisfactory progress, the opportunity grant would be there for them in their second year. Students in years 3 and 4 could still get the grant as well, but there may be higher academic standards required. In the broad category of targeted uses, the shared responsibility model remains in place, but the language in this bill will make plain that in tight fiscal times, first priority for the grant will go towards the neediest, for the lowest income students, based on the EFC calculated on the FAFSA. To the extent that racial and ethnic data is available, the OEIB equity lens will be applied to all funding decisions. Earlier, I made the point of extending the application deadline is an important consideration, and here's why. This slide fairly graphically represents the most recent selection of students eligible for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. You'll notice that long green bar to the far left. These are the poorest of the poor, students with an EFC of zero, and you'll notice that those at community colleges outnumber their peers at universities more than 3-1. In fact, if you totaled all the numbers from all these columns, you'd find that community college students make up about 69% of those eligible for the Opportunity Grant. Public universities make up about 26%, and private universities make up about 5%. Contrast that slide to this one. This slide shows the way the grants are currently distributed. While community colleges make up about 69% of the eligible students, they are currently getting less than half the grants dispersed. This picture is even a bit more dire when you consider that community college students are less likely to attend full-time for the full year. So while they make up 69% of the eligible students, they are getting about 44% of the money. We found the reason for this discrepancy was simple and predictable. Community college students tend to commit to attending colleges later in the year, and our early application deadline was shedding out a great many low-income students out of contention for the grant. Students who had a network of family and friends familiar with the college application process or who had an active school counselor had a distinct advantage, which leaves out many of the students we'd been trying so hard to reach. Following the presentation of the work of the working group at the May 2014 meeting of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, a design team was formed to further explore the recommendations of the working group. Made up primarily of financial aid experts and former members of the working group, they found that there are a limited number of variables available when redesigning the Oregon Opportunity Grant program that is funded insufficiently to meet the unmet need as defined in statute. These variables include grant size, eligibility requirements, and the length of the award. Therefore, over the course of five meetings, the design group established for the following principles to guide in the ultimate design recommendation. First principle, prioritize students with the highest financial need and demonstrated skills for persistence. More specifically, the opportunity grant would be awarded to students with an EFC of zero, as calculated by the FAFSA, thereby supporting those with the highest financial need. If additional funds are available beyond this threshold need, additional grants would go on to students with an EFC up to $500, then to students with an EFC up to $1,000, and so on. In order to reward persistence, the amount of the award would be set at a minimum of $2,100 for the first year awarded to zero EFC students, and be guaranteed for the first 2 years of attendance, provided students maintain satisfactory academic progress and have remaining need. The second component prioritizes supporting students that demonstrate promise toward completing a degree, certificate, or credential. And third, the application deadline for receiving the opportunity grant would be set for a later date, potentially as late as August. The deadline currently falls on February 1st. Moving the deadline would increase access for those who, for a variety of reasons, do not apply for aid until just before the beginning of the academic year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Bob, maybe you're going to get to it. Maybe I missed it. I guess I missed how you're going to engage those needy students that have been identified that haven't been applying or have applied late or whatever the case may be. Increasing the opportunity grant or saying that we're going to focus more on the neediest of students. I think we've been fairly focused on that, but if you're not engaging them before or in the future, how are you going to accomplish the goal? Am I making that clear?
Co-chairs, Representative Huffman, thank you for the question. So the issue is that if you looked at applicants that file their FAFSA, and you looked at students that had higher income ranges, had family members that had been through college and so on, or students that are going to public university, they tend to file in January. This is for a variety of reasons. Number one, they know the system better. Number two, they have people pushing them to get those documents in. Number three, universities often have an earlier deadline than community colleges, which are kind of open enrollment a situation. And so if you looked at the applications of university students and higher income students within the opportunity grant eligibility criteria, that curve is very sharp. If you looked at very low EFC students and community college students, they tend to trickle in more slowly. And so by focusing on what we've done is previously we've just kind of treated all these students as equal, and whoever gets their application in the earliest has the highest likelihood of getting the grant. As I've just explained, that tended to be students that had strong support systems and students that tended to go to universities and actually higher income students. So what we're proposing to do is actually kind of set that money aside. That's probably a bad term. By focusing on the lowest EFC students, what we will be doing is we will be able to allow that that income, the stream to extend out farther. So we'll be serving the same a greater number of students, but we'll be more closely matching our distributions to the applications of lower income students. So it's not that these students aren't applying, they're just applying too late for our current deadline. We'll be able to move the deadline out later because we won't be overwhelmed with all these higher income students getting the grant at the beginning. I'm not sure if I explained that very well.
I think I follow. We're not going to necessarily send out an army of advisors to engage these potential students. We're just going to maybe hold back some money, if you will, so that when they do find the right door and get their paperwork in, there will be some money left for them. Hopefully.
That's right. And I apologize. I'm an economist. I'm lost without my graphs. So if I had a white chart, I could show you, but thank you. So what are the budgetary implications of such a change? The governor and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission have made access and affordability a very high priority in this budget. Not only have they asked for significant increases in funding for community colleges and universities, but they have requested a large increase in the opportunity grant as well. The budget request for the opportunity grant this biennium is slightly above $143 million and represents a 22% increase over the current service level budget. All other things being equal, we would expect to be able to award nearly 43,000 students per year. Not the 120,000 we'd like to serve, but a huge increase over the 34,000 or so we served each year of this biennium. Under the methodology proposed in this bill, we would be able to serve several thousand more students per year than under the current methodology. This is simply due to the fact that students that get the grants at community colleges are less likely to take a full class load all year, so their average grant award is smaller.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe, maybe you're going to come up to it, but how many are being turned away then? For how many are applying and not getting a grant?
Co-Chairs, Representative Taylor. So under the shared responsibility model, if we're serving 43,000 out of the 120,000, then essentially 77,000, my math is right?
Okay, so 77,000 are not going to be getting, unfortunately, anything, right?
That's correct.
Okay, follow-up. So the ones when you are selecting, it seems that a lot of people would meet the criteria of, and I think this is great, by the way, and I'm really glad that you're doing this and that you're changing the way that you're awarding the money and that it's not the first come, first serve, and changing the deadline. That all makes sense to me. But there'll be a lot of people who are going to meet the same criteria. So within that, what is the final selection methodology?
Coach,
is it down to literally that family has one more dollar than the other family, or how detailed is it?
So, co-chairs, Representative Taylor, thank you. So if I'm understanding your question, so our methodology would be we would serve all zero EFC students first, And if there was money left after that, we would serve all $1 EFC students and then $2 EFC students and so on.
And if we can't serve all zero EFC.
And if we can't serve all zero EFC students, then again, it would be the students that get their applications in soonest, but hopefully we would, that deadline would be out in June or July rather than February.
Okay, thanks.
And remember when the introduction was being made by Mr. Cannon, he said that the number one priority, if we find additional money day after tomorrow, the number one priority ought to be to beef up the grants available so that we can serve more of those needy students. Springer. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. In going through the slides, and maybe I didn't get far enough ahead of us here, what is the percentage of opportunity grant recipients that complete a four-year degree?
Co-Chairs, Representative Springer, thank you. I don't have the figures with me right now, but I will I'll provide those to you. We have, the OUS researchers have looked at that, and it's higher than other non the non-opportunity grant recipients significantly.
Go ahead.
Follow up. Thank you. And as I went back through a couple of the slides you had a little earlier, it talked about, is it true you can receive the opportunity grant for 6 credits?
Yes, Co-Chairs, Representative Springer, yes, thank you. So a student can receive a half grant for between 6 and 11 credits per term. They have to at least complete or attempt 12 credits to get the full grant for that term.
Go ahead.
So then how many years would that part-time student be eligible for an opportunity grant?
So it is based on that ratio of 4 years at 12 credits per quarter. So
so 8?
So essentially, yes, 8.
Go ahead.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead.
What I'm getting at here is I think the opportunity grant is an absolutely wonderful thing, and I just want to make sure it gets to the students that are completing and getting degrees. And I know that that it is very common to really fund that first year in college. And colleges love to do this, give you a lot of money, get the hook, and keep you there. And then that money starts dwindling, and we've set people up to fail. I'm not saying that's what's occurring here, but I am saying that's a pretty common paradigm. And I want to make sure that we're not just handing out checks, that we're putting the supports in place 8 years, if so be it, to complete and get those degrees and get the most most bang for the buck, quite frankly.
Co-Chairs, Representative Springer, I think Mr. Cannon can talk potentially about some of the mechanisms that we're trying to put in place at the colleges and universities to provide those supports through our funding mechanisms. Well,
go ahead,
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Springer. We'll describe some of that in our presentation tomorrow around incentives and supports for institutions to provide the kind of support, and it speaks to Representative Huffman's question about engagement to support completion. I would just, in the context of this presentation, I would just point out the dilemma, and it's almost an unsolvable one, about, on the one hand, prioritizing students who have the greatest need and for whom the opportunity grant may have the greatest impact versus prioritizing students who may have the greatest likelihood of success, right? If we really wanted to focus the grant on students who are most likely to succeed, we'd focus it on higher income, better supported, better prepared students, right? And that, and I think we wouldn't want to shift too far in that direction. On the other hand, there's a risk if you swing all the way in the other direction and the dollars are going entirely or primarily to students who don't have the sufficient levels of support, engagement, outreach, then you risk putting a lot of dollars into students who don't complete, right? What we're trying to find is that sweet spot where we're maximizing the grant's impact on completion. And that does require corresponding strategies around engagement, around support, mentorship, coaching, counseling, none of which are we speak to directly in this proposal, but which institutions are very much invested in and we're trying to support through other work.
Go ahead.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Co-Chair. Well said. I want to make sure that I'm clear that there is ultimate success is upon an individual's shoulders, quite frankly. However, we have reached out a hand and we're engaging, and so we have some responsibility as a state, i.e. the universities, the public universities anyway, to bring the supports and the effort alongside that student to give them the opportunity and the tools to succeed if they so choose to do that. And I don't know that it's responsible, and I'm not saying that this is what we're doing, but I don't know that it's responsible to say, we'll give you money to fund it. Good luck. Mm-hmm. Go and do great things. I hope it works out for you. And so I want to make sure that if we're able to extend this amount of this bucket of dollars, that we can also extend a bucket of dollars that says, we've got some supports here. If you want to take advantage of them, we're all in
Absolutely.
With you.
Absolutely.
Representative Huffman, and then Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think we've seen a bit of a sea change. Not that it wasn't there before, but not to the extent that we've seen the last two and a half years. When I wanted the opportunity grant looked at compared to with through the lens of 40-40-20 and degree completion, Bob said basically it hadn't been being tracked, and so that it was going to be challenging actually to even answer Representative Springer's question. And that was the main focus at the time. What I'm hearing, though, is through the work group and through the equity lens that we're hearing much more about today that we heard very little about 2011 to 2013. We're viewing a lot more stuff through the equity lens also, which is, I'm using that term because Nancy uses it a lot and it's being thrown around a lot. So what I hear you saying is we're now looking at two goals, equity for the opportunity grant recipients, equity lens and degree completion, both. And so maybe tomorrow you're going to get into how you're going to balance those two goals with $143 million.
Senator Monroe, Representative Huffman, I think you've described the goals, and there is some tension, let's say, between them, or it requires a balancing. I think you've described them quite well. Our hope is that the proposals in front of you today around the opportunity grant for the redesign in 2407 and the additional funding strike the balance. Bob's yet to describe one feature of the proposed redesign that speaks in particular to the completion priority, and he'll get to that. And tomorrow we'll describe not directly in the context of the opportunity grant, but more generally, the ways in which the commission is proposing to use state dollars differently to reward and incent colleges and universities to focus on support student completion for all students, not just opportunity grant students, through our funding models. So I think we're trying to do both. We hope that this proposal finds that appropriate balance, and we'll describe tomorrow additional ways in which the commission's work supports the completion goal.
So when you say support, that was going to be the next area I wanted to go to. Like Rep. Springer, very supportive of the opportunity grant, but I'm not supportive of just throwing more money at a problem or perceived problem or whatever. And I don't want to get ahead of you, but if you could explain at some point today or tomorrow how the heck is approaching our independent university partners whether they be state community colleges or state universities, they're all fairly independent at this point. How are we encouraging them to have expand the advising capacity so that the students do have a better rate of success, so that they're identifying challenges with a student early enough that they can help get them the support tools that, that they'll need to complete a degree, be successful?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, Representative Huffman, I think you're spot on, and your thinking and concerns are highly consistent with the HECS. And tomorrow we'll describe some of those mechanisms. We also have within our budget, and we'll talk about this on Thursday, we have a proposed really continuation and potential expansion of our Aspire mentoring program that gets in a small way at a portion of the advising and sort of support challenge. So yes, we hope that these efforts will be taken as a whole. I think a scholarship program and a fairly mechanistic one. I mean, look, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of applications. Bob does not know these students in the way that Representative Springer and other Aspire mentors know their student. I mean, it's a totally different kind of relationship, right? It's not the support. It is, to a large extent, a formula-driven scholarship program. But to see it in isolation from other things that primarily institutions, but also programs like Aspire's do to provide supports and policy mechanisms at the state to invest in and support those would be, you know, insufficient. We have to see those two. We have to be doing both. And I hope that over the next couple of days we'll lay that out.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah. When it comes to students that's going to a community college and they take the entry exams and they are given courses that are not transferable, they're not degree courses, do those credits that they're earning in those count towards the 12 hours for the opportunity grant, or do they have to be actually courses that move towards the degree?
Co-Chair, Senator Roblin, yes, they can use the opportunity grant towards those courses.
All of them, okay. Number two, not that it should be a part of the determination, because I think right now what we're doing is the right deal, but are we doing statistical information on finding criteria that give us a better understanding of completion rates? So from those kids that we complete, are we gathering data around things like their GPA, their scores on other tests, and so on? Because I've seen a tendency of some of the more elite universities to go away from standardized tests as even an entry deal. They don't even ask for them anymore because they have not been a good predictor of success at their institutions. And so as we invest more and more money on those kinds of tests, are we doing anything to see if those scores translate to completion, not to whether they get a B on their first English class, but is there any comparison? Because what we're finding is there's less validity for standardized tests, SAT, ACT, and completion than universities would like, because they're getting held accountable for completion. They're entering people on standardized tests, and that may not be the best indicator of what leads people to success. Are we doing anything about trying to find out what those other indicators are that might help us inform who would be best served by these along the questions that they're answering?
And Senator Robum, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we have for the public universities, and that the HECS now retains this data and responsibility, we have quite a bit of data, and there has been quite a bit of analysis done by universities and by the Chancellor's Office previously on those relationships, particularly between high school preparation as expressed through GPA and SAT scores and college success. You're right, GPA, my understanding is that GPA has been a much stronger predictor of college success than test scores at Oregon public universities. I'd be happy to follow up with any additional sort of gleanings from that data over many years.
I'm just thinking that there are times when I believe, and this is a hard one to categorize, but where a teacher recommendation about a student, and I know that for a long time at our high school, the University of Oregon, Oregon State, would take teacher recommendation over GPA and other scores with respect to those kids who they thought would be successful. And so kids from certain schools with lower GPAs would get into the school before other people did, because the feeling of the university was that instructor that knew them well, who saw their tenacity, their other kinds of things, was a better predictor of getting a person through than any other indicator. So I don't know if we do that anymore. We still ask for recommendations, but I don't know if we have a way of categorizing that some of these other indicators are better predictors of student success and better predictors of the kinds of attitudes and other aspects of that child's life are more predictive than others. And are we trying to gather any of that? Because I look at the amount of money we spend on doing things like tests and other kinds of things, and we say we're doing that because we want to get the right people in the school and encourage them to get the right skills so they'll be good in the school, when in fact we may already have that in a different way through people who have interactions with those students. I just hope that we look at those things.
And Senator Roblin and co-chairs, I think this discussion would be particularly fruitful with admissions staff or others from the universities themselves, who could describe the ways in which they're making those difficult decisions, particularly at the selective public universities. I think that what we may be able to provide is the evidence from the data points that the Chancellor's Office has historically kept, which would not include the teacher's recommendation. But I think there's a lot to be learned from those admissions offices themselves and their experience in looking at individual applications and then following students through to success.
Representative Huffman, then Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Roblin, for asking a question that opened up another can of worms. Based on the testimony of the number of students that we're not going to be able to serve, I would, just speaking for myself, not the whole committee, I would strongly encourage you guys to go back to the drawing board on what classes we pay for. And if we are paying for classes that don't go toward a degree, we need to stop that. If we don't have enough money to spread around, then we shouldn't be giving money towards something that doesn't count toward our state's goals. 40-40-20 being number one, and then the equity lens, however that. I don't see paying for classes that don't count feeding into either one of those goals.
Either one of you want to respond?
Senator Monroe, Representative Huffman, I think it's a important line of conversation. I think it's something that we'd certainly be interested in, a conversation we'd be interested in having with the commission and with others. I will note that the developmental ed, which is primarily, I think, what we're talking about at community colleges, does serve, is an important on-ramp for students to degree-bearing courses. So we certainly understand that developmental ed reflects for recent high school graduates really likely some shortcomings in their high school education. It also, for returning adults, reflects a significant gap in time for many since they were in high school, and just a reduced skills, at least academic skills, associated with that gap, and their opportunity to enroll in developmental education provides an on-ramp eventually to degree-bearing courses. But I understand the concern, and I think it's an important conversation for us to have, and we'd be happy to follow up on it.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. I actually was going to ask about what was the thinking behind it, and you went ahead and answered that. So I appreciate that. But maybe I missed it, but what percentage of students are taking, when you're giving out the grant, what percentage are taking the developmental ed classes versus classes towards credit, classes that receive credit for? Do you have any sense of that? Is it most? Is it half? Is it?
Representative Taylor, co-chairs, I don't know that we have that for opportunity grant students specifically, although it may be possible for us to find out through sort of integrating some data, which we have some ability to do now, hopefully greater ability to do as we develop as an organization. It is the case that for recent high school graduates who enroll in community colleges, so this is a subpopulation, right? Because community colleges serve a lot of non-recent, and then, of course, we have the whole universities. The majority, it's in the sort of 60 to 70% range, enroll in at least one developmental education course. So it would be reasonable to conclude that many Oregon Opportunity Grant students at community colleges, by many I mean most, the majority, are enrolled in at least one developmental education course. You know, we'd have to think about how to take that into account under a award methodology.
Thank you.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't know that you necessarily have an answer or a response to this, Ben, because you are the Higher Ed Coordinating Council. I want to differentiate. There are some distinct differences between the high school student who leaves in end of May, June, and goes to the community college in September. There's a huge difference between that person and the person who has been out of school for several years.
Yeah.
I was one of them. Went to college right after high school, and then went back to school for a new path at 40. I felt pretty remedial, quite frankly. I don't know. Anyway, we won't go there. That said, what is the conversation, if any, that takes place between the community college and one of its local high schools about the majority of your students come here and need remedial math? I get what your specific, what your role is. That said, it is this body's role to be looking at that, especially when we're talking 40-40-20, especially when we have OEIB, and it's all about a continuum now. What is the conversation, if any, that takes place between the community college and the high school that says, almost all your students take remedial math? That's not okay, because that is a high school responsibility, not an opportunity grant responsibility.
Representative Springer, co-chairs, yes, and those conversations are occurring. And I'll give just one example. I attended a convening of the regional achievement collaboratives perhaps a year ago, last summer, I think, in Bend, at which the leaders of those collaboratives, which included school district leaders, K-12 leaders, community college leaders, university leaders, received at each sort of table group the data for their region, for their school districts, on precisely the question we're talking about, the percentage of their recent high school graduates who required remedial developmental education when they enrolled in a community college. They got that on a district-by-district basis. Working with Ed Northwest and Michelle Hodara, a researcher there, we now have this data. So we can go to a superintendent or a principal and say, here's what's happening to your students. It's a really important conversation. I think it's one that a lot of K-12 and obviously higher education folks are paying attention to. We are part of the challenge here, and to be fair, this is not all about K-12. It is about, in part, an alignment of expectations between higher education and K-12, an alignment of sort of assessments, if you will. I think there's opportunity, and this is now going to get potentially quite a far afield, but it is important that community college and university leaders are recognizing the potential value of the new assessment, the new 11th grade assessment, Smarter Balanced, in signifying college readiness and using scores from Smarter Balanced to help exempt students from developmental education. This will have, I think, a positive effect on students and the appropriate use of their 11th and 12th grade years. It's not nearly a complete answer to the challenge. It doesn't get at preparation per se, but it does get at some of the alignment issues, because part of what students experience is taking a test, taking a 11th and 12th grade courses, then taking a summer off, then showing up in the fall, getting a different test aligned to a different set of expectations when they show up at the community college in September, and lo and behold, it places them into developmental ed. That may or may not be a reflection of their skills and abilities in the subject. So there's a lot of work occurring on this. Agree. I think it's among the very most important data points, certainly for our OEIB, the sort of P20, and continuum to think about the integration and alignment of our sectors.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So it doesn't sound like we have data today that says what we're doing a better job with what we're doing. It looks like we're in the beginning of this process. If I'm wrong, correct me. So I would like to see in the 16 session in this committee data that says we're getting better. I'd like to see data, and I sure hope the data says we're getting better at this.
Madam Co-Chair.
It's not a question. It's a statement. If you will recall back to last week with the deputy superintendent's comments when we were talking about assessments, there is no doubt in looking at the K-12 history that our assessments, our OAKS assessments, were not asking for high-level thinking skills. And so I think what we have here is now the convergence of the reality that a lot of our K-12 students were not college ready. And that's something that I have personally tangled with and didn't want to believe, but it is a reality. And so I think we're in a major transition, and I can't think of a good metaphor this morning to highlight what that kind of feels like, but that's where we're at, and I believe that we're going to do much better in the future. And so some of that groundwork data that Representative Springer's talking about would be invaluable, so that, you know, our economists can show us more charts in the future with different outcomes. So thank you.
You bet. Senator Roblin.
I guess I'll go along following just a statement. High-level thinking skills are not the skills that are on the tests that community colleges give for entry into the programs. I've looked at them a lot because we used to give them to our kids in junior year because we wanted them to be ready and take that last math class when they're a senior instead of not taking any math. And English was the same way. The issue that I have, again, it goes back to the first conversation with respect to teacher recommendations, would probably tell them better. Community colleges are doing something that I think is probably essential, and that is having these pre-course courses of 1 week to 2 weeks in duration that before they have to take the test, they can sign up for it and get 2 or 3 weeks of math instruction, which gives them the language again, because half of the time when you take the test, you don't know what they're asking for, so it's really difficult to do well on the test if you don't remember what you took in your junior year. But if you have a short example at the beginning, all of a sudden they score a lot better. So they knew it at one time. They just didn't recall it when they got sat down in front of a test. And we have had students who went off to Oregon State as engineers and did well in their first year, come back to go take the next classes in the college and not pass some of the tests. And so they wouldn't let them take the test, even though they'd been successful at an Oregon State in their engineering department. So there's a lot to do with getting people in the right place and causing them to have to take courses over which a brush up, a little explanation would have done more than taking a whole course and putting them behind in the system. So I hope we figure out a better way to make that transition smoother. And I know that as we work on OEIB and other kinds of things, that is one of the real transition areas that we need to figure out a better way of helping. And having courses at the community colleges that in somehow we help pay for them, because right now we do it on a different credit deal. Those people that are coming back to school after having been out for a while, they don't need a whole course sometimes in math. What they need is, brush me up, let me feel comfortable again that I can go take a math class or an English class so that I know the language, so that we have a common conversation. So figuring out how, as we go through this process of transition, how we come up with new opportunities to guide people in the right place so they don't waste their time, but they can focus and get after it. Because I'll tell you that most of the students that I know that came back when they were 25 to 35 to 40, my wife was one of those same people that went back, they just needed a chance to get back in the lingo. I mean, it wasn't about taking a whole courses. It was about remind me what I used to know so I can get there. And they are more intense and they're more driven and it doesn't take them as long. And I would rather them get on course quicker. So thank you.
And gentlemen, we have about 10 more minutes for you today because we have some people that want to give public testimony.
Thank you very much. So,
and it's not your fault because we like to talk. But
that's true.
Go ahead.
So I wanted to basically walk you through the impacts of the distribution model change that we proposed. So in the big picture, here's what happens. On the far left, you can see how the grants were dispersed in the current school year. In the middle is what things would look like if we allocated our new budget request based on that same allocation formula. And the column on the right shows how things would look if we prioritized the poorest students first. Yes, there is a shift of grant recipients between universities and community colleges. However, the columns on the right much more closely match the actual incidence of need across the three sectors. If this bill and budget were approved, we would work hard to make sure that the university students wouldn't be left high and dry. The previous chart showed how the number of grants would be dispersed, and this chart depicts how the dollars would flow. Again, there's a shift, but not as great as in the previous chart because the grants at community colleges are smaller and will likely continue to be. As I've said, a full-time opportunity grant is available to a student taking 12 credits per term, and a student can receive the opportunity grant for up to 4 years of full-time study. A student taking 12 credits per term, or 36 credits per year, would accumulate 144 credits by the time their opportunity grant eligibility expires. However, most bachelor degree programs require 180 credit hours to complete. A student with only 144 credits would need another full year to complete their degree. It's estimated that a typical student who completes his or her degree in 4 years will realize $175,000 more over the course of his or her lifetime when compared with a student who takes 5 or 6 years to complete. The delta includes 1 or 2 years of additional employment, 1 or 2 fewer years of accumulated loans, 1 or 2 fewer years of tuition, fees, living expenses, and so on. It's clearly in the student's best interest to finish in 4 years, if they can. It's also in the state's interest to incentivize students to complete in a timely manner. The sooner a student completes his or her studies and is gainfully employed, the sooner they're contributing to the workforce, their community, the economy, and the tax base of the state. The state of Indiana recently changed the definition of full-time for their need-based grant to be 15 credit hours per term or semester versus the 12 credit threshold in Oregon and saw very large gains in students taking the heavier class load and graduating in 4 years. For these reasons, House Bill 2407 includes directing the Higher Education Coordinating Commission and OSAC to develop a proposal we're provisionally calling 15 to Finish. Under this
I don't disagree with you, and I support this program, but sometimes there are individuals where it's a little different. I took 5 years to get my undergraduate degree. I was married. I was working full-time. And at the end of that 5 years, I signed a teaching contract that paid me $2,000 a year less than what I was making on my job that I put myself through college on. So... just think how much money I'd have if I hadn't done that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
So under this proposal, all the benefits and requirements of the earlier opportunity grant redesign changes I just explained would remain in place for students taking 12 credit hours per term or 36 per year. However, if a student chose to increase their class load to 15 credit hours a term or 45 per calendar year, the state of Oregon would give them a supplemental grant that would potentially increase their opportunity grant award the following year to offset any increase in tuition at their home institution. For example, a student that received $2,100 of full-time reward as a freshman but completed 45 credits over the calendar year, in their sophomore year, full-time tuition at their college increased by, say, $500, rather than the $2,100 award they would expect had they only completed 36 credits. Their opportunity to grant would be $2,600, the $2,100 base grant plus the $500 to offset their tuition increase. Staff believes that any incentive model could yield strong results if the patterns in Indiana is an indication. Students receiving the base award in 2016-17 would be eligible for the 15 to finish award increase starting in 2017-18 and for subsequent years. The full cost of the program would not be known until year five. Since this would be an entirely new model with no history on its success in Oregon, we'd anticipate hiring a professional data modeler to help model participation and cost estimates for future years. And this would be a contracted position. Once due diligence is completed on the 15 to finish program, the HEC would determine how much, if any, of the appropriated opportunity grant budget would be directed towards this incentive. And that concludes my presentation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions on the grant design or our budget request.
Are there additional questions? Madam Co-Chair.
I'm asking if there was a change or if my memory's off, but to me, when I was going to school in my late 30s, and this was in the late 80s, I took 12 credits, but when I paid for my 12 credits, I knew I wouldn't have an increase in tuition if I took another 3 credits. And so you could take 15 credits, and then when I got to the university, I could take up to 18 credits and pay the same flat tuition. So it was an incentive to take more credits than just the basic 12. So when did all that change?
So Representative Comp, thank you. So that's commonly known as a tiered tuition level, and many schools have had that in the past. I think the last university in Oregon to discontinue that program was Oregon State just this last year. I don't think any of the universities currently have that.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I know for a fact that Eastern Oregon University is allowing their students to enter into a contract, if you will, a compact, where if they will commit to take 15 credits each term, they will graduate in 4 years, and they will not experience a tuition increase. How many other universities are doing it? And if that is our smallest, isn't it, Ben, our smallest university? If they have the capacity to do that, I would certainly think our other universities would have the capacity to do that.
Representative Springer, co-chairs, I'll give a partial answer and follow up with any missing details. There are really two two different models that Eastern is putting into place. One is the notion that courses will be made available to you such that if you take 15 credits, you can complete your major in 4 years. It's sort of the guarantee of availability. Portland State University also has a similar sort of pledge to its students recently. The other thing Eastern is proposing to do is essentially the tuition, they call it a tuition promise, where you are guaranteed a flat tuition for 4 years. Western Oregon University has also operated a tuition promise model for several years. That does require paying more at the outset, mm-hmm. right, than your peers, but then being guaranteed that rate for 4 years. So the two work very nicely in conjunction with each other. I think it is promising, and the commission has supported those efforts at Western and Eastern Oregon University. We're required to do so in part because of it triggers our approval requirement under the 5% tuition increase because they have to charge more in order to get them started.
Okay. Additional questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much. We will see you tomorrow. And at this time, I already opened a public hearing on 2407, so we will call on Mr. Larry Roper and Mr. Tim Cowan to give public testimony. Welcome.
Good morning. Okay. Co-chairs, committee members, my name is Larry Roper, and I'm a professor at Oregon State University, and I had the pleasure of chairing the Opportunity Grant work group. And just wanted to spend just a few minutes just talking a little bit about the process, but also Just talking about some of my experiences during that process and why I believe this is such important work. But before I do that, I was really struck by the conversation. I, in my experience, haven't had the opportunity to sit in convenings such as this, and I just really want to express appreciation for just the thoughtfulness of the conversation and the questions and the depth of commitment that they showed. In fact, it's influenced what I want to say as a result of that, because I think the questions that you ask about student success. And making sure that we're investing in the right ways is really important. So as we began our work with the work group, it was very important for us that we kept the needs of students at the center, as well as the 40-40-20. And what we concluded about 40-40-20 was that it was not an access agenda, it was a completion agenda. And that, therefore, in the design of the opportunity grant, we really needed to focus on completion. And so we really thought that predictability in the model, in having those sort of first 2 years guaranteed, and then incenting students to do well in order to continue in that, in terms of looking at success, we're going to be very important pieces of it. So we wanted to do two things. We wanted to facilitate access, but we also wanted to stimulate completion. And what we know is that the opportunity grant for, I have spent more than two-thirds, it just dawned on me, two-thirds of my life working in higher education. And in my role, I live with the stories that you were asking about on a daily basis in terms of the students who come from particular life situations who need unique supports in order to be successful there. But we also know that the presence of a grant like the opportunity grant can be hope-inspiring for young people. The idea that there is something there for them. If they just hold up to their end of the bargain and they get through high school and they do their work, that it's a pathway out of poverty. Yeah. And I know that for myself personally, higher education was a pathway out of poverty. But you need some help in that. And we believe that the opportunity grant, and particularly a well-funded one, would be really important in that facilitating that pathway. We also, in the process of doing that work, it was heartbreaking work because the question that came up is what happens to those students in the end who still have high need, who don't get it, that there are students who will still not be out of there. So, you know, the fact that the opportunity grant is underfunded was sort of a heartbreaking part to that, that there will still be unmet need and unsupported students who will still be out there. And so our goal was to try to make sure that we did everything we could to provide access for every student possible through our process and through our work. And so we just believe in the end that the grant as proposed will provide opportunities for thousands of low-income students and really help them to reach their potential. And in the process, will contribute obviously to the prosperity of the state and allow people to be able to live socially meaningful, socially relevant lives and to really feel a sense of pride at having completed something that previously may not have been accessible to them. So I just want to thank you all for the thoughtfulness that you've shown in your deliberations and in your conversations and questions. And I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Roper. Are there questions for Mr. Roper? Well, thank you, and thank you for your comments. This probably is the most experienced and thoughtful committee dealing with education in the whole of this legislative body. That's just my unbiased feeling. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your work on the work group and helping guide that process. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Mr. Cowan?
Co-chair and committee members, I just have two different elements. The first one is the to the bill. There are a number of things I'd like you to
name on the.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tim Cowan.
Thank you.
First of all, there needs to be a couple things that need to be defined, and I've provided that in the written part of it, so I won't go into that in a lot of detail. But it just addresses in the bill. It mentions a manageable debt burden of the student, but it's not defined. It talks about the family share, but that's not defined either. And I've listed a bunch of questions relating to that. So I guess the thing I would like to talk about outside of that written testimony is I was a teacher, a former high school teacher, and when I looked at this bill, I wanted just to let you know that people learn differently. There are different rates or types of learning, and I think that needs to be considered whenever you look at that. I was not one that worked well in a normal environment. I did not memorize very well, so I did it by application. So it wasn't until I could apply what was being taught would I remember it. My church, South Lake Church in West Lynn, entered into an agreement with Roosevelt High School, and because of that, now Roosevelt High School has the greatest improvement in graduation rates. And the reason for that is because it's amazing what teachers will do when they're supported, but it's even more amazing when students think you're interested in them. So one thing that I would like you to think about is the environment that the students come from. That can be devastating for some of these students, and I think that needs to be taken into account. The last thing is on testing. So one of the things that you mentioned on testing, we all take tests differently, the same way that we learn. And I think one of the most difficult things you're going to have to work through is how do you identify students that are eligible for not only entry into college, but also how to complete it. Just as a side note, and I don't mean to take a lot of your time, in high school, my sophomore year, I had a C, two Ds, and an F. For my sophomore year, my father was the principal. I don't learn that way. And then the last thing, and then I'll go. When I talked with former Governor Frohnmayer, who then was the president of the University of Oregon, we talked about the cost of a college degree. Colleges sell the importance of the value of a degree. For example, you go get a master's program. Students that get a master's program think, I'm going to get more money than my peers that have a bachelor's degree, so I'm going to delay my entry into the work environment by 2 years and incur more student debt. And student debt right now is the toughest thing for these kids. Because my daughter, as an example, has been paying on her student loans over 10 years, and my son over 8 years. And there is now, since 1990, which was $300 billion in student loans, now, based on New York Times, 2014, it's $1.1 trillion. And if you didn't have student loans, the national debt would be 6% higher. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cowan. Other questions for the witness? The numbers that you asked for at the beginning of your testimony are available, and I don't know if Ben, if you have those now, or could you provide them to the witness? Those numbers are available because I've seen them. So, but thank you for asking, and thank you for your life's testimony. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
And is there anybody else in the audience that wanted to testify this morning on the grant bill 2407? Anybody? Anybody going once? Okay. And Doug, anything for the good of the order?
You'll want to close both of the public hearings.
Okay, we can do that. We close the public hearing on 2407, can't read them without my glasses, and close the public hearing on 5024. Okay? Thank you very much. Appreciate all your hard work. We will see you all tomorrow. We're adjourned.
You mean we're back again? We don't get another. Yeah. You mean we're back again? We don't get another.